Boom. Hey, hey, and welcome to the next episode of An Ordinary King. Where do I start? Geez, this next guest is a absolute legend of a dude. I had an amazing time meeting him. His name is Dan Nixon. He is a writer. He's got a workshop thing going on here in Melbourne for young writers and adult writers as well, people looking to get into the industry or just write in general. He has a production company here called Pirate Sized Media, and they do some really cool stuff. Look, it was amazing fun, this podcast. Had a great time chatting to him. He's incredibly interesting and such a diverse character. I don't know. Hang in there. Check it out. It's a cool one. Welcome, Dan Nixon. Yeah.
Great.
So thanks a heap for doing this, man. This is really cool. I've been really excited about this.
No worries. It's a pleasure.
So I guess I kind of just want to sort of cover what we've just been talking about since I got here, and just sort of who you are, why you started doing this, what motivates you to do it, and yeah, about the things that you got going on, like this amazing spot, this cool studio that we're in at the moment, and yeah, just sort of who you are as a person, dude. You have pretty exciting stuff going on.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry. Really, really happy to talk about it and share. There's a lot going on at the moment, so yeah.
And the tea's great, too.
Yeah. tea helps every situation.
Let's just go back over sort of who you are and sort of where you come from. And
yeah, cool. I mean, so in terms of to getting where I am right now and the different things that I'm doing, you know, my journey has definitely not been typical. It started out in a way that would have suggested that it was going to be a typical journey towards, you know, being a professional storyteller.
Yep.
Or teacher of story is basically what I do now. But I started studying drama when I was at came out of high school, and then I ended up leaving that and following a different path after a couple of months, and for many years just tried pretty much everything, put my hand to, you know, everything from working as a ski instructor to teaching drama and percussion to at one point I trained as a helicopter pilot.
What?
Yeah, totally crazy. And it was one of those things that I'd never thought that people could have, you know, someone would have a natural gifting for something like that. And yet you totally do. Like I got terribly airsick and never got over it. And I just couldn't stick with it. So I tried everything basically.
How did you get into?
I had this romantic notion around the life that a helicopter pilot would have.
You didn't get that watching The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, did you?
No. Yeah.
Drinking beer out of gumboots.
Well, I mean, the crazy thing is I had this romantic notion around what it would be like. And then I set out. I was actually flying fixed-wing aeroplanes because it's a lot cheaper to start that way.
Crazy.
And I did it for a year and a half. And I was actually started flying around the time of the Black Saturday bushfires, right, here in Melbourne. And it was a really, really hot, dry summer. Yeah. And, you know, I was flying out in the Yarra Valley, really turbulent. And I was just like, I had that idea, that romantic notion that I'd had ripped out from under me straight away.
Reality.
Because it was like, it was horrible. It was like stinking hot little box. Bumpy. I constantly felt sick, and so I had that romantic notion ripped out from under me. And essentially, what that, you know, that didn't lead me to going and studying writing, but it was a couple more years.
Something a little bit more grounded.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like quite literally,
ink is way less catastrophic than turbulence.
Exactly. So it was. I actually kind of after that, I was like, I just kind of took the little bits of experience I had from all these different jobs and roles that I'd been in and travel I'd been doing. I was like, well, what can I do? It was like, well, stories is what I wanted to do to begin with.
Yeah, right.
When I was in high school, you know, I loved writing, but I was never particularly confident writer. I gravitated much more towards theatre and that side of things. And then eventually I came around to deciding that I wanted to study writing. And that's kind of the start of this journey.
Where you're at.
Yeah.
Is that something that you've always like? So storytelling is always something that you've been linked to or wanted to do since a young age?
Definitely. Although as a kid, I probably wouldn't have been able to articulate it that way. I wanted to entertain, I guess, is what I thought. You know, I always loved the idea of, theatre and the circus and all of those sorts of things were what attracted me earlier on. The notion that there's people who, you know, do things like writing television never even crossed my mind as a kid. So it was a slow journey towards realizing that actually you can be a writer and that can be a job, and actually being a writer and having a job as a writer can mean a lot of different things.
Crazy. Yeah. And so where did you study?
So I studied at a small college just outside of Melbourne for my undergraduate, which was an arts degree. And then I went to the Victorian College of the Arts and did a master's degree in screenwriting. Yeah. The course was pretty young. It had only been running a couple of years, and I was one of the first people who went through with a focus on writing for kids that not many people had written for kids. Sure. So
that's been your focus all along.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it was just sort of a natural thing. So by the time that I started the VCA, I'd written a lot of theatre and had worked a lot with kids in the theatre space. Through all those turbulent times, or not turbulent times, but times of not really knowing what I was doing with my life, the most consistent job I had was teaching tap dancing. I taught tap dancing to this group of boys for like 10 years. And so I'd always worked with kids in one way or another. Yeah. And it was just the stories that I told just naturally, because I understood that audience they just naturally started to flow in that direction. So yeah, and it just happened that all the ideas I had at the time were for kids, and then I sort of slowly pigeonholed myself, but maybe in a good way. So
crazy. I don't know about much of a pigeonhole. It's a pigeonhole with a lot of different doors going.
Yeah,
it's
for
pretty
sure.
Crazy.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
It's a big world of its own.
Yeah. And then so once you finished VCA, how'd you go from there?
I was no different to any other student, and then I was like, you know, what next? How do I from here? You know, you can't go on seek.com and find a job, you know, for a screenwriter advertised.
Nothing comes up.
Occasionally LinkedIn has weird jobs pop up, but they're always in some obscure country essentially the industry that we're a part of, the broad creative industry, as well as the film and television industry. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really work that way. So I went out and I basically started pitching my own ideas around I would go to markets and networking sessions wherever I could and that sort of thing. And on top of that, I was starting to form relationships and doing a lot of spec writing. So for those who don't know, spec script writing is basically writing an episode of an existing show to show that you can capture the voice. And so, yeah, I did that. And then I ended up working for a year as a development and production assistant at the Children's Television Foundation. And then from there, I realized that, you know, if I wanted to make my life as a writer sustainable, then I needed to kind of take my destiny into my own hands. And so I decided to hedge my bets and start two businesses, one being a production company that makes children's television shows, and the other being this space that we're sitting in right now, which is a creative writing studio for kids.
It's amazing. It's a crazy space. The best thing about podcasts is that you can't see where we are. So
sometimes you don't want to see where you are.
Yeah, it's true. this space is really cool. It's like this really crazy old sort of pub kind of building.
Yeah, I think it was actually a bank originally.
Yeah,
it was an old bank.
It's nice. It's light. It's in a really good spot. It's actually a lot quieter in here than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, we're right on the corner of Nicholson Street and Scotchman Street, with two busy streets in Melbourne. But as soon as you close those doors, you know, these walls are over 150 years old and they're thick. You know, so it's pretty quiet in here once you close
all
the doors. So.
And what's this wheel? We've got this sort of Wheel of Fortune thing. Over
So it's a spinning wheel. You should give it a spin and we'll probably pick up the noise. You'll hear it does a good... Yeah, that's the Wheel of Fortune vibe going on.
An orphan.
An orphan. You win today's prize. You can have a new car or an orphan. You won an orphan.
Oh, sick.
So basically it's a wheel. It's a story wheel. So there's all different things. We rub them out and write different things on them. They're story prompts, basically. So we don't use it that often here in kind of day-to-day classes, but we take it to festivals and events and those sorts of things. And kids can spin the wheel and get a couple of different ideas. And the idea is there's things on the wheel. Some things are easy to incorporate into a story. Some things are hard to incorporate into a story, and you have to use whatever you land on. So,
can I have some more, please, sir? Some more,
yeah.
That's
crazy. Well, I mean, there's a definite, there's a disproportionate amount of children in stories who have lost their parents. It's the orphan trope is actually such a massively...
You haven't weighted that wheel to stick like a magnet behind orphan or something like that,
so that it can constantly land on orphan. Believe me, we don't need to. The amount of young writers who come in here whose story starts by the fact that they or their character has been orphaned, it's I don't know what it is, but kids gravitate towards that idea of being alone. And would that be like?
What do you think motivates kids to do creative writing?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think all of us have an inherent inclination towards stories and wanting to tell stories. Yeah. I think that we lose confidence as we get older, and certainly part of what we do here and part of what I'm so passionate about. So kids come in for creative writing classes after school or during the day on Saturdays or whenever it might be. And our focus really is on storytelling. It's not on teaching the spelling and grammar. That comes later. It is part of what we do, but it's not the craft of writing. It's the craft of story that we're passionate and focused on. And I think there's a huge shift there. Kids get really excited when their ideas are supported and encouraged, and where they can just go for it and, dream big. And there's essentially no rule. I mean, there's rules to what makes a good story, but there's no rules in terms of what you can write about if you want to. And so, I think that just excites kids, and they can step outside of their, I don't think it's any different for kids as it is to adults, really. They just love the, opportunity to step outside of their own lives and imagine what it would be like to be someone else in some other place and go on adventures they've never had and all those sorts of things.
You feel restricted, though, as an adult, don't you, going into something new? There's always like those boundaries that you put, those, whether they're social or whatever they are, those obstacles that you put in front of yourself. But as a child, those things don't really seem to exist, those walls that you put up as an adult as you go through life and get scars for emotional or physical, you start putting up walls, and so new experiences become more difficult to handle and articulate how you're feeling in new experiences. But kids just seem to have this ability to take something on that's new,
definitely,
and really relish it and really grow into it.
Absolutely. And that's a big part of what we're trying to do here. I mean, so this space that we're in is called Melbourne Young Writers Studio, and we've only been around for a couple of years, but we've had so many incredible stories of kids who come along and just have zero confidence when it comes to not just writing, but just they don't think they're creative individuals. And yet as soon as we strip away a lot of the rules around you need to write neatly, or you need to have great spelling and grammar and those sorts
of
things, and
focus stuff.
The boring stuff that ultimately that stuff will come if you actually just start writing. So if you actually do it well,
spelling is so terrible.
That's right. The reality is the more you write, the more you're going to start to actually grapple with those things. But if you're only ever forced just to address those things, then, it's a problem. Particularly we've got every kind of young person imaginable who really comes along here, and, kids on either end of the spectrum in terms of kids who are really passionate and gifted young writers, and other kids who need a little bit more help, maybe struggling at school or whatever. But we've seen some really exciting transitions and kids stepping into being much more confident, particularly young boys who haven't seen themselves as creative because perhaps they're sporty or been told that's the thing that they're good at. Just by encouraging them and supporting them in the stories that they want to tell and challenging them as well in how to do that better, we've seen huge changes in those young people, and it's awesome.
What do you think the main challenges faced with kids when they, aside from either spelling or grammar or trying to do things right or what they think is the right way to do, what do you think the main challenges with kids and maybe adults in coming into a script or starting to tell a story and articulate it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think it necessarily matters what form the story is taking, you know, whether it's a play, whether it's a screenplay, whether it's a, you know, a poem or a novel. But I mean, I think that on a very basic level, it's communicating what you care about. I think that's ultimately the backbone of any good story is how do I actually communicate what I care about and do that well. And then we get into all of the, you know, the more of the kind of story craft elements, things like character and conflict and, you know, structure and world and those sorts of things that, you know, you need to learn how to do those things well and understand how to do those things well. But I honestly think the biggest hurdle that any storyteller has to overcome is actually how do I just write what I care about? How do I tell a story that I genuinely care about? Because I think that, I mean, Andrew Stanton, who's the, some people may know the name Andrew Stanton, probably many people won't, but you all will have seen his films. He's pretty much been the screenwriter behind every Pixar film. Yeah. But he, you know, he often says, you know, a writer's main job is make me care. Just make me care. I don't care what else you do. If you can make me care, then you've got me. And I think it's the same for, you know, for kids. Kids are, you know, little adults in that they're grappling with the same struggles and confusions about the world around them. And they're trying to find answers for those things for themselves. And so I guess that their struggle is exactly the same as ours. Yeah.
Do you think the types of stories that people are telling and wanting to tell are changing?
I think that's an awesome question. I don't think so. So I think that we return to the same big kind of meta themes over and over again. You know, each new generation is still exploring these questions of who am I? What am I going to do with my life? You know, these big kinds of questions. However, I think the way that we're starting to see stories packaged is looking different. You know, I was having a conversation a couple of weeks ago with a Melbourne screenwriter, Peter Mattesi, who's worked on lots of kind of local stuff and really great writer. But he brought up a really interesting point that the emphasis, particularly talking about screen content in recent years, has much more gone towards the world. You know, that we look for kind of an engaging and interesting world, and that, you know, any TV show or film used to be able to name the characters. But even if we love a television show or film, how often can you walk away and actually name the characters? But the world's really, it's a theory, and I don't know exactly how.
Good.
But it's an interesting one. I think like the value placed on world has in some cases superseded character, and I think world's become a huge thing in the way that we see stories portrayed. But that again,
so do you think you mean like by world, do you mean that it's no longer about the characters going through the world, but it's about how the world reacts to the characters?
I mean, that might even be giving it world a little bit more credit. I mean, I love the idea of world being like a character and the way that characters actually interact with their world.
Yep.
But I think it's just that, you know, I think the danger and what Peter was probably suggesting is the idea that, we look for a world that seems exciting and unique, but that's not enough to compensate for, you know, well-written characters. You still have to have well-written characters. And, you know, with the rise of streaming services and the massive content, we're seeing so many, you know, new shows come out that are sparkly and, you know, have engaging looking worlds, visual worlds that don't necessarily have the characters to actually
substantiate
and to keep people coming back, you know.
I've been thinking about that because there's so much more content now than what there was even 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think for me, the ratio still stays the same. You could have 1,000 shows and 50 or 100 of them might be good.
Yeah.
And now we've got 10,000 shows. It doesn't mean that there's 10,000 good shows.
No, no.
You know, or films, that, you know. I always think there's like a 5 to 10% ratio.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, for me personally, that I watch something and I feel engaged versus something and I'm like, oh, maybe they should have spent another couple of years on the script, or maybe they should have put that script to bed and taken some ideas from it and improved on a different story or something.
Definitely.
I don't know. There's so many things out there that I feel like... I mean, 10 points for people, because it's such a difficult process, as you know, getting something from one development to production and then producing it, having it shot or animated mm-hmm. or written, and then actually put out in the world and sold and for people to see. The process is grueling and tough and not very friendly at all.
For sure.
So, so 10 points to those people that get things out there, full stop. It's a feat. It's almost immeasurable, I think, the struggle that people go through. But I don't know. I think there's just so much content now. It's so
definitely. We have more choice than ever before in history in terms of the stories that are available to us. And yet, you know, it doesn't mean that there's more good stuff than ever before necessarily. You know, there probably is more good stuff just based on the numbers, but there's probably also more bad stuff, and it's just it's just a bigger job to, you know. And also the way that we consume content has changed, in that, you know, we don't stick with stories the way we used to. You know, if something's not grabbing us in a pilot, we have the option just to choose what else is on, you know, what else is there. Like, you know, Netflix has so many new shows coming out all the time, and they're just one of the many platforms. You know, you can, if it's something's not gripping you, then you just move switch on. And change. And
what is gripping you?
Oh, it's a really good question. So I teach a course in critiquing television at RMIT, and I'm in a bit of an unusual spot in that I deliberately do flick between things, but not because things aren't gripping me, because I'm trying to watch lots of different things and challenge myself in the stuff that I watch. I guess some of my favorite shows of the last fairly recent years, I love The Detectorists, which is a fairly recent series. It sounds like the worst premise ever. It's basically two guys living in a small English village whose lives are pretty boring, and they're hobby metal detectorists. They go out looking for treasure with metal detectors, and it's just a really heartfelt series. And I just came back from Miami a couple of weeks ago pitching shows at a big children's television market over there, and I've never heard the word heart thrown around so much. Everyone just wants something with heart, and I don't necessarily know what they mean by that.
Yeah.
But I feel like we all get a sense of it, and that show, The Detectorists, has a lot of heart. It's really, really good.
Do you think heart's charm?
Yeah, I think it's charm. I mean, honestly, what is heart? Like, it's got a lot to do with that idea of make me care. Like, it's...
Sure, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's like, if it's, you know, if it makes you care, because why would you care about, like, two guys whose lives are really, really boring who, you know, go metal detecting on the weekends? Like... That's like, okay, great. Each their own. You have your hobbies, I'll have my own. Mm-hmm. But there's something about those characters in that story that you just resonate with, and you care about them. And that's heart, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of shows out there. What's it called?
The Detectorists.
And is it on Netflix?
It's on Netflix. I think it's also on ABC iView. I mean, that's not indicative of my taste in any way.
Sure,
I watch all sorts of things, but that's just something that I've enjoyed recently.
I still like watching Antiques Roadshow.
Oh yeah. It's a bit of a guilty pleasure. I really like it. It's such a weird show, but I don't know. I mean, it's not that far off Detectorist. It's the thrill. It's the thrill of the hunt, you know, that's really not what that show's about, but yeah. Antiques Roadshow. Are they gonna, you know, whoa, this like, I still have this memory of this one episode of Antiques Roadshow I saw, where a lady brought along a glass bottle that she literally pulled out of a skip, like a big bin, the back of this house that was being renovated. And it was round. This glass bottle was round. And she took it to Antiques Roadshow, and they told her it was worth £10,000. Yeah, it was like one of the oldest examples of a wine, like early wine bottle ever found in the UK. And she just found it in a skip, like crazy.
In a skip,
yeah.
As if she dropped it straight after a shot.
Yeah, I mean, that would be good television.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be the playlist would be up on YouTube with that one. Yeah. It would be high as. That's crazy. Yeah, it's a pretty funny show. I like it. There's lots of different stuff out there. So what have you got coming up with this, and what kind of workshops do you run? Because you run for kids, adults.
Yep. So I'd say 90% of the work that we do here at Melbourne Young Writers Studio is for kids. Kids come in after school or on the weekends for hour-long workshops, either in a small creative writing club. So we're sitting at a table with six seats here, and we've got a couple of them in the studio. So kids will come in, five kids, one workshop leader, or it might be one-on-one, like a private mentorship. So that happens all the time throughout the week. We also do holiday programs. We've got a bunch coming up. We're doing a partnership with comedy festivals for some short comedy writing workshops. Yeah, we're doing two with the Collingwood Children's Farm, where we're doing basically a writing on the farm day for kids. And then a couple of other workshops here in the studio. So that's happening. There's a whole bunch of things. We're going to be at the Fitzroy Writers Festival on the 6th of May. So there's lots of stuff going on.
Where do you see this workshop place going?
It's a really, really good question. I mean, at the moment, I'm just kind of enjoying the ride. It's great. Like as everyone knows, starting any new business is hard. Starting an arts business is harder. Starting a youth arts business is, potentially even harder. And so I've just really enjoyed the journey and seeing the business grow and get to the point where, things are looking good now. So I'm happy to kind of ride the wave a little bit. Our focus before we do anything else is on getting as many kids into this studio as we possibly can. I don't know, we've been thinking about doing some pop-up studios at other places around Melbourne. I'm writing a screenwriting program for schools at the moment that's going to be, we're partnering with the Australian Teachers of Media on, is going to be delivered into schools later this year. So yeah, there's a bunch of different things going on. I mean, this is only one small part of what I do. And the reason why this place is great is that I've got great people who work here. Bonnie, our studio manager, is really great, and we've got a heap of really good workshop leaders who the kids love, and really talented writers in their own right. So it's thanks to them that this place has been successful so far. Yeah. And that the kids love the experience of coming here. For me personally, I do most of my own writing through my production company, Pirate Size Productions, which is a kids, children's and family company. So yeah, we're in a bit of a different place with that company in that we've got lots of shows that we've been working on with broadcasters all over the world, particularly broadcasters in the US. And at some point that's going to demand a lot more of my attention. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just kind of preparing for what that'll look like when that happens. Yeah.
What do you think that will look like?
It's a good question. I mean, my plan is to not step away from the studio, but to have this writing studio running self-sufficiently, so that I don't have to be here too often. I mean, I'm fortunate in that we're in Fitzroy North right now, and the production company is in Fitzroy. So we're literally just, the two businesses are just down the road from each other. So I can always drop down here if I need to, but we're just waiting to see what happens. We've got a bunch of animated shows that have been in development with broadcasters in the US, and we're just waiting to see what tips over. We've got a short film coming out next week with Sesame Workshop, who do Sesame Street.
Crazy.
So that comes out next week. So keep an eye out. Sesame Studios YouTube channel. Check it out. It's a little fairy story.
Yeah, I'll put that on the, I'll link it on the.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, I've got to give all the credit to my awesome business partners there, Simon and Alyssa Briney. I mean, Simon and Alyssa did the animation, and it looks really beautiful. So yeah, excited for that to come out. And yeah, so that's the tip of the iceberg. There's a bunch of other stuff. We're doing got a really weird, I can't say too much about it, but a weird kind of animated family show that we just found out is getting funded by Screen Australia for development, which is awesome. Nice. And we've partnered with Dan Harmon's company, sure. Dan Harmon's creative Rick and Morty, over in the US. We're developing that together with Starburns Industries, his company. So yeah, there's heaps going on. So, but in terms of, like, you were talking before about, you know, how hard it is to get into this industry, you know, my, I give this analogy a lot, but I always feel like I'm doing that thing in the circus, you know, where they have like plates on top of poles and they're spinning them. And it's like all these different projects going on and all of these different things. And, you know, you spin all these plates and some of them are inevitably going to fall over, but we hope that one or two of them was are going to stay standing up. And, you know, I think that's kind of, that's the, my, been my approach to everything that I've done, you know, a couple of different businesses. See, we, so, you know, fortunately both my businesses stayed standing up, but then with the projects for, that we're doing at Pirate Size Productions, you know, I don't know which ones of those will stay standing up. We cast the net pretty wide in terms of doing lots of things, because we know it doesn't matter how good the show is. Doesn't matter how, you know, much work you've done on it, there's a heap of external factors that at some point it can just still just fall over.
There's so much out of your control.
Yeah, it's hard. And you have to, you know, I think you have to have thick skin to go into, you know, the film and television industry because of that. So
you do have to be a bit of a rhino, don't you? You know,
you have to be prepared. You have to be prepared for a lot of knockbacks and for a lot of things that may not, you know, work out, even when they look like they're sure to work out. You know, until I always say, until you've signed the contract, until you see the money, it's just hard to know.
Exact same thing. Yeah, because there's always things like where you've got a story or a script or there's something in development and it's all copyrighted and you're shopping it, and then someone's, you know, a company will get back to you and go, great. And then, you know, and I'm always apprehensive about telling people about what's going on, because you always get the same response. It's like, oh my God, that's amazing. You must be so excited. I'm like,
Yeah.
No,
sure.
just chill.
Yeah.
until that check comes in, or until you start filming or shooting, or, there's no guarantees. Even guarantees aren't guarantees anymore. You know what I mean?
For sure.
There's just so many factors, like you said, that can go awry or that change overnight.
Yeah, it's crazy. Know? And it's, you know, it's a reflection on the fact that this industry, the film and television industry, is in a state of constant change as well, you know, constantly seeing companies acquired by other companies, new streaming platforms opening up. One day there's heaps of money available, the next day there's zero money available. I think you've kind of got to accept that a lot of it is outside of your control and do what you can. I mean, I mentor a bunch of screenwriters, and my advice is always, you know, have multiple things going, have multiple projects going, because you just don't know, you know.
Yeah,
and it's just good practice to have multiple things going. Particularly as a writer.
Yeah, but what's always handy, because if someone likes something that you've done, they're always going to have that question of, well, what else have you got?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the reality is, like, I learned this really quickly when I started going to markets and started pitching things. Like, they always ask that question, because, as you said, you know, if they like it, they'll say, we love it. What else have you got?
Yeah.
And if they don't like it, they'll say, what else have you got?
Like,
you get that question anyway, and if you don't have something else to show, then it doesn't look great, you know.
No, even if it's not good to what they like initially.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be developed to the, you know, you can't have a, you know, a bunch of complete feature films in your back pocket. Not everyone can, so you just, you know, it's multiple ideas is what you're talking about. And, you know, I mean, interestingly, my process of the shows that we have sold at Pirate Size Productions has been, you know, we used to do these pitch documents, beautiful illustrations and all this story work, and they'd be like 30 pages long. But then all of the shows that I've sold have been on pretty much a single image and a single log line.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Because companies want to feel, executives and producers want to feel like they can speak into something and shape it in the way that they want it. So, yeah, it's a weird one. Like, I think the best advice to, you know, young writers and creatives wanting to get out there is have a handful of really good ideas and then just get out there. Like, don't go necessarily too far down the path of developing things, because you may shape it in a way that just, you know, even if they love the idea, they may want to take it in a different direction. So
you've also got to remain fluid and flexible.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. If you're too headstrong, I mean,
holding things lightly, you know.
Like if something, you may have like what you think is a really good idea, you can sit on it for 10 years if you want, you know, and being stubborn about what you think the story needs. But at the end of the day, I always say, define what it is that you're doing this for.
Yeah.
And so are you doing this for yourself as something as like as a release, or are you doing this as a career where you want to professionally do this and produce things or write things or whatever? And then if you can answer, then answer, you know, those questions. And then if you want to do it for other people, understand that there's a massive audience out there that are going to support that career of yours. And if you can't, you need to be able to cater for that audience. You need to be able to remain flexible, because it's all subjective.
Yeah.
And that's the half the problem is having a business model within an art frame, an artwork frame, because it's not like selling socks.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, it's, but at the same time, it's still a business. You've got to be able to sell your vision and your creativity.
Definitely.
And arts is not the most amazing business to
yeah.
It's so fickle. Yeah. It's subjective. It's all subjective.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think that idea of kind of holding things lightly, because you don't know, you know, everyone has different opinions. So
yeah, I don't reckon too many people know exactly what everything's going to happen at the same time. What, you did paragliding. That was interesting. I just see you were first going like, what else do you do? I know. Like I digress.
So I did, it's I did an intro course to learn to paraglide. Was it last year? I think it was last year. Yeah. So one of the coolest sports I've ever tried, and really, really fun, quite terrifying. Like, you know, and I'd flown planes before, like solo flown aeroplanes before. There's this like beautiful simplicity to paragliding, but it's literally string and cloth that's holding you up in the sky. It's pretty full on.
What's the theme with you wanting to fly?
Whoa, I don't know. It says something. I don't like definitely
helicopters,
like,
airplanes.
Yeah.
You're losing like, the engine, man.
Well, I know the crazy thing is that like I'm actually like an insanely nervous flyer. Like
sure.
I'm a really, really, really nervous flyer. But definitely what I've learned, you know, over time is that it probably has a lot more to do with my inability to let go of control. Because when I'm the one in control, I don't feel anywhere near as scared, you know? But also like I kind of like I've always been drawn towards things that terrify me a little bit. Like I don't know what it is. Like I love doing things that scare me a little bit.
A bit of risk. Yeah. Bit of controlled risk.
I mean, you're a surfer, aren't you?
Yeah.
But see, that's like the ocean's the one thing that I just I can swim and I like mucking around in the surf and stuff, but like it's the ocean's kind of next level for me. It scares me more than the idea of being up in the clouds.
Like, come out, man. I'll take you out. I'll teach you to surf. Chuck you on a big longboard. You'd be sweet
cool.
ass.
Yeah, well, if it's like, let's choose like a nice calm day.
Yeah, it's like, heaps of places. Yeah. I won't go to Torquay. It's too busy. It's way too busy. Yeah, surfing's great fun. It's like there's, I was chatting to a friend of mine, actually Leo, who's I just chatted to on the podcast recently. And he says, there's this theory people have, or there's this thing that people have when you're surfing. Apparently it's impossible to think about anything else but surfing while you're surfing on a wave.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of why.
For sure.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I surf is because I have so many things going on in my life and my mind, I always have a lot of trouble sort of calming it and thinking about just focusing on one or two things.
Yeah.
But surfing is the one place where I get to sort of, not so much switch off, but just relax the thoughts and just focus on one thing at a time.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I don't know if you've seen before, but there's a Japanese philosophy called Ikigai.
No, I haven't.
Which is really cool. If you should check out, just Google Ikigai. It's IKIAGI. I think I definitely spelled that wrong. But anyway, just like roughly put those letters into Google in any order and you see what comes up. But anyway, it's basically this idea of like the balance in life. But part of the idea of Ikigai is this idea of flow tasks, things that you do in your life that allow you just to be completely invested in that moment and in that thing. And it can be anything, you know, surfing is a perfect example. It could also be pottery or drawing or writing. Writing is amazing flow task. The only issue is that for me, writing could never be a flow task because it's also what I do for my job. So yeah. it needs to be something separate to what you do for your job, but something that just takes you away. I mentioned earlier on today that, you know, I was always drawn to kind of towards the circus and the theater when mm-hmm. I was younger, and that's kind of stuck with me because I think circus tasks, or what do you call them, skills, circus skills, like they're those things where like there's an element of danger and risk associated, yeah. and you have to be completely invested in it and in the moment. Yeah,
like when they're trying to get 18 clowns into a minute. yeah,
you got to be focused, really, really focused.
Oh, that is some contortion.
Like next level Tetris. Yeah, it's I've always like I've got this little thing where like every year I give myself like a new kind of just useless, not useless, but like just fun skill that I'm going to try and master that year. And it's just about fun. It's just a release. So last year, my thing was mountain unicycling. So I bought a mountain biking unicycle.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things when like you're on a unicycle, like you can't be anywhere else but on a unicycle. I mean that, like, I mean that not, you know, literally you can take a unicycle wherever, but you inside your own head.
It's like this little Pandora's box. This witch wardrobe thing.
Inside, yeah, for sure. You
jump on it in another world.
Well, there's a story in that.
Don't tell anyone. We'll spin the wheel afterwards.
An orphan on a unicycle. it just went weird places. Literally, other worlds. The idea of when you're doing that, you can't be anywhere else. You're just invested and you're totally focused on what you're doing. And it's so great. Like I can be insanely stressed out with whatever I'm doing, you know, writing or business stuff or whatever. And I'll go and jump on the unicycle for 10 minutes. And it's like re-flicks the switch.
Can I clarify?
Yeah.
So when you say mountain bike unicycling, it's not like a unicycle that you hit mountain bike tracks on. It's like it's a mountain bike or a unicycle. Is that right?
No, it's the first thing. It's literally it's literally a unicycle made for going down mountain bike tracks.
Oh.
But I'm not like I live in the city, so I'm like, well, in the north, but so I'm normally just riding around the streets. But I have taken it on a few mountain bike tracks. It's pretty so full.
Fraught with danger. That is
it's pretty intense. But look it up. Mountain unicycling on YouTube, you'll lose your mind. It's insane.
I could think of a dozen other things that I thought would have existed in the world before that existed. I think that has just become my new favorite YouTube search.
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome. Watch it. Like, it's insane. And they're like custom, these bikes. It's like they've got big tires, suspension, a brake like the under the seat.
Really?
Yeah. It's full on. Yeah. And people like rip down mountains in these things. It's crazy.
Do you think the wingsuit is next for you?
Sorry?
Do you think the wingsuit is next for you?
Oh, no. No, I can't do that. My uncle's like, sorry, Steve, if you're listening and you're younger than this, but my uncle's in his late 50s, 60, around that, and he's wingsuits.
Right on. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah, I really want to give it a go.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. He's skydived all his life and was like, if there's any, he was in his 50s, and if there's any time I'm going to do this, and it's now, and bought a wingsuit and goes, you know, he skydives for a living. Like, he takes people tandem skydiving. That's his job. But then, for fun on the weekends, he goes wingsuiting.
What does he reckon? Has he talked about it much?
Yeah, I mean, he says it's pretty amazing. He says that, like, it's just the toll it takes on your body is pretty intense. Like, the force and the pressure, you know, you're traveling, like, you know, over 100 kilometers an hour or whatever it is, and the force of the pressure of the air on your body, you know, the saying that, you know, he wished he'd got into it when he was a bit younger, because you have to be super super fit to wingsuit. If you haven't seen this will be your new favorite YouTube video. Have you seen the wingsuiting video where the guys jump out of an airplane and wingsuit down and fly and land in another airplane?
Yes, I did. I did see that. It is insane. I actually watched the build up to that as well, where they were practicing. and then we'll go past their airplane and like,
yeah, it's insane. Oh, just like, it's like so, like, it sounds so like high tech and scientific, and then there's literally just guys standing inside the airplane with mattresses, like ready to catch them just crashing into mattresses. It's amazing. It's crazy. Yeah,
wingsuit's crazy. I really would love to do it. I think it would be the toll on the body. I completely agree with that. Like, how could it not? It's incredible force, like the wind, and you're traveling at amazing speeds. But that is like, I think, another task where you're like, you cannot concentrate on anything else other than what you're doing right then and there.
Sure.
That is like,
oh, of course,
immediate focus.
I mean, that's like next level flow task. In that, if you're not concentrating on what you're doing, you're gonna die.
You will die. Yeah. And people do, unfortunately. Yeah. But that is man.
Yeah. Talking, if anyone hasn't seen it, the ultimate film about flow tasks that just recently came out is Free Solo, the film about Alex Honnold climbing not Half Dome. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's still climbing. I watched the
Yosemite.
I watched the TED talk on that he did on that, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
But just the how. The initial thought that you have when you go, I free soloed the Yosemite. I'll get there. It's been one of those days. I've been on the precipice.
Yosemite.
All day. I've had like two coffees, and one of them nearly like put me on the event horizon. I was like hanging on like all day, and I've been splurring my words. But when you initially hear him say that he soloed, climbed this thing, and it was no rope. And I
El Capitan,
that's it. Yeah, it's actually my screensaver. And that he climbed this thing, no rope. You're like, okay, that's one, some people perceive that to be crazy. Two, that's if you fall, you're gone. But then just the level of work and focus and attention that he put into it. And one of the things that he mentioned in the TED talk about doing it was that the fear of actually failing and not doing it right, because he did a climb just before he actually tackled that cliff. He did another cliff where he didn't quite put the same preparation in, and he made one mistake.
Yeah, that's right.
And he said that taught him so much, making that mistake, that he never wanted to make that mistake again. So just muscle memory. He climbed that muscle memory.
Yeah, it's insane. It's next level. That's terrifying.
He said it was harder climbing it with ropes.
Yeah. Maybe because I don't know. I can't imagine to be in his mind. I mean, they do in the film, they do those like tests on him, and he's basically, his fear receptors are like dead. Well, not dead, but like he just doesn't, you know, he doesn't experience fear in the same way that most of us experience fear, which probably helps if you're going to, you know, do what he does. So, but anyway, amazing film. And that's got to be the ultimate flow task, you know.
Mountain climbing solo.
Solo, like one free. Slip, you're gone.
Yeah, that is ultimate focus, surely. Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that, because one thing he talked about while he was doing it, that he found his mind wandered too much. And I wonder if that's like coming from doing it too often.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He's becoming too good.
Yeah.
And complacency, that's what the mind wandering is.
The thing that got me so much about that film was, it's all the build up to the moment, and you know, it's elite sportsman mindset in that he has to be entirely focused, and he makes the first attempt when he didn't quite do it and didn't feel good about it and came back and then tries again, you know, a year or whatever it was later, and goes for it, completely focused mindset, gets up like the first couple of pitches, and there's these guys camping on the wall and a guy comes out of the tent dressed in a unicorn onesie. Like, if anything's going to screw with your, like, focus and your mindset, like, I was just like, you can't write this sort of stuff, you know. This guy who's camping on a vertical wall comes out morning having slept the night in a unicorn onesie, and, you know, how do you not let that rip your focus? Like, it's amazing.
People, if you haven't seen it, you totally need to see it. It would have been amazing to have seen it at IMAX, and I think that would have been incredible.
I was like, I had like sweaty hands at the end of it, and I was like gripping my, because there's all this like talk about, you know, it would be fascinating to be part of the film crew for that, because there's obviously, even the film crew, they're all elite climbers, but there's all this talk about, you know, nothing can distract him, you know, he can't see you, he can't hear you, you can't make noise, because anything could, you know, be the distraction that essentially causes him to fall and die. And so then when after the film sets this up and then he's climbing and it's all fairly quiet, like there were people in the cinema, like, you know, making noise with their popcorn. And like, I seriously had to stop myself from turning around and was like, shut up. You're going to like cause him to die. Cause I was like so invested in that moment. It's like the can of Coke opening and like, come on, people.
It's a well put together film.
Yeah. It's really good.
Yeah. It's pretty clever. And, I don't know where did pirate size productions come from the name?
Oh, that's a really, really good question and a little bit of a sore point perhaps with my business partners there, because I started the company with one of my business partners, Alyssa, who happens to actually be my cousin, and then Bryony and Simon, who are our other business partners, came along a little bit later. So they actually didn't really have a choice in the name, because by that stage we'd been using a name and it had kind of stuck. But essentially it came from what I thought was a slightly hilarious conversation with a friend at a pub, but we were probably just a little bit drunk. And was like, this would be a great idea to call a company Pirate Size. Pirate Size. And I think, you know, what size is a pirate? Well, a pirate can be any size, you know. It's the idea of, you know, kids telling epic stories, and it made sense in my mind.
Okay, I can see.
But now we've kind of gone down the path, and that's the name we've got. So,
you're sticking to it.
Sticking to it. It seems to be working. Yeah. People really like us.
Yeah.
We've just been dubbed the Little Pirates. The Little, like actually us, the people who work there, the Little Pirates. So,
do you have Pirate Day?
We do celebrate Pirate Day. We normally put an original animation out each year for Pirate Day, something to celebrate. And
do you dress up?
Well, no, but we should dress up.
Embrace.
I mean, we need to go out if we're going to do that. I mean, we could just sit alone in our little office, I guess, like, you know, dressed as pirates. That would be pretty cool.
The problem is, though, with the area that you're in, if you dressed up like pirates, you kind of fit in.
Well, we're on Smith Street.
You just don't look any different. Yeah.
It's like by far from, it's definitely not the weirdest thing that people wear on Smith Street.
I remember going to the SB once in St. Kilda. That's actually just been refurbished. This is years ago. My God, this is longer than 10 years ago. And some people came dressed in newspaper wrapping. Wrapped in newspaper. Yep.
Great.
Yeah. And they got in. They got in.
It was each their own.
Yeah. Yep. They were happy. It was pretty funny. It was good. I liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love the vibrancy of, you know, of this part of the world and the Melbourne. Different characters. And And particularly when you get into those pockets of Fitzroy and, yeah.
So what made you come to Melbourne?
Well, I've lived in Melbourne for a really long time. I grew up in northeast Victoria, up in very close to Bright, a country town, the base of Mount Buffalo and the ski resorts there. And moved around a bit when I was much younger. My dad was a park ranger, and I mentioned to you before we lived in New Zealand for quite a while. But Melbourne's been my home for definitely the majority of my life. And I've always kind of been I'd always had the idea in my mind that I either want to live in a city or I want to live way out in the country. I'm just not interested in the suburbs. I tasted that and I had my taste of that. So we live in just not far from here in Clifton Hill, and it's a really great little community. Everyone knows one another.
Good coffee.
You can, you call on your neighbors whenever you need them, and it's really good. So it's very similar to a country town in that way. But our plan is in the future to live further out in the country.
And
it's the beautiful thing about being a writer is that you can live wherever, and you know, even in production world, like, you know, the majority of projects that we're working on are on the other side of the world anyway. So broadcasters don't mind if you're in Melbourne or if you're in a small country town, you know, or on a farm or whatever.
Or
in Fiji, like it doesn't make a huge difference to them. So yeah.
It's amazing. Like I'm blown away by so I promise I'm not stuck on the unicycle. Have you done a GoPro sort of footage thing? Have you done anything like that with it?
I've taken some videos and stuff, nothing that I've shared, but I've got
any scars from it? Have you come off?
Not from unicycling. I've got some good scars from some other stupid action sportsy things that I've done. But I haven't had any serious falls on the unicycle yet.
I cannot believe that it exists.
Well, it's let's crazy. Do it. I mean, you take me out surfing one day, yeah, and I'll take you out mountain unicycling one day.
I'm going to die.
You maybe need to start on the flat first and just
build my life.
Learn to ride a unicycle is kind of a prerequisite, I guess. But you know, much like probably knowing how to swim if
is
you're going
to
go out in the ocean.
Is it as hard as it looks to ride a unicycle?
Honestly, no. Like it's. I just don't think it's anywhere near as hard as it looks. The hard bit is getting on, because it's all about momentum. So sure, once you're moving, you're sweet. Momentum and balance, obviously. So once you're moving, you're pretty good. But it's just the getting on and off is the bit that takes a little bit of work.
Reminds me of, I heard a story the other day that, you know, Segways?
Yeah.
So the guy that invented the Segways actually died riding a Segway off a cliff.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the definition
it's
of irony,
funny,
isn't it?
It's
crazy. It's funny.
Pretty
no,
ironic.
It's funny.
It's pretty funny, yeah. 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 You just couldn't ride. I mean, you could ride it, and people do, but I don't know, like, is there anything else that you sort of want to add or jump onto while we're
talking? No, I mean, other than just like an invitation to anyone who's listening. So here are I said that we mostly do kids programs, but we're doing more and more programs for adult riders here as well. And we have a staple every Thursday night. We do an event called Words and Wine, and it's literally just drop in, come along, write, work on whatever you're working on, and do it in a supportive environment, share a drink and share some stories. And it's really fun. We normally do a little riding activity at the beginning. So 7:30 till 9:30.
Do you use the wheel?
If you want to come along, we can use the wheel. Oh, yeah. Everyone's going to be writing stories about orphans. Because as we established earlier in this conversation, the world doesn't have enough orphan stories. Yeah. It's been too long since
It's way too long.
It's been even too long since Harry Potter, really. You know, 20 years. No, there's a
what?
I think it's at least 20 years, yeah.
Oh, I suppose, yeah, he must be, because he's up in his 30s now, isn't he, Daniel Radcliffe?
Yeah, I thought you were going to say Harry Potter. I was like, it's not real. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
I don't know, crazy. Well, it's been, I guess we'll, yeah, it's been really crazy and really good catching up with you and meeting you. There's way, way more than what meets the eye.
This conversation went places into all different sorts of directions and tangents.
It's really cool. But it's awesome. So, yeah, come down and check it out. Thanks so much for jumping on the show. It's cool.
No worries. Thanks for having me. It's a fun conversation.
Peace. All right, thanks guys for listening. Thank you to Dan Nixon for jumping on the show and having a good time with us. It was a mad chat. I hope you guys liked it. I had a lot of fun, and I think Dan did as well. Don't forget to subscribe. Check out more podcasts that we've got coming up. There's some really cool guests in April that I'm super excited about to introduce and chat to you. So hang in there. Peace. Catch you soon.